After having examined all of his records and all available reports about him, I arranged to have a military clinical psychologist, Dr. Alvin Jones, conduct a full psychological assessment of Frederick in September 2004. I reviewed those data as well as the independent blind evaluation of the MMPI testing that had been done by an assessment expert. In addition, I administered a measure of psychological burnout at the time of our interview, and an expert on job stress independently evaluated its results. Let's start with some general background, add some personal input from family and some of Frederick's recent self-evaluations, and then review the formal psychological assessments. Chip was 37 years old at that time, the son of a 77-year-old West Virginia coal miner father and a 73-year-old homemaker mother. He grew up in the small town of Mount Lake Park, Maryland. He describes his mother as very supportive and caring, and his father as very good to him. One of his favorite memories is working on vehicles in the garage alongside his father. His older sister, Mimi, 48, is a registered nurse. He married Martha in Virginia in June 1999. They met when she was a trainer at the correctional facility where he worked. He has become the stepfather of her two grown daughters. All his life, Chip has attended Baptist church services regularly, at least every other Sunday. He considers himself a moral and spiritual person, even after his involvement in the abuses at Abu Ghraib. Before going to Iraq, he attended the local community college and went on to take courses at Allegheny College in Maryland, but did not finish his degree. He was an average C student, never failed a course, and liked to learn new skills. Chip, however, is more a jock than an intellectual. He played basketball, baseball, football, and soccer in high school. As an adult, he continued to play softball as a left fielder, hitting for a good average rather than distance. His main hobbies are hunting and fishing. He is also a people person who has a great many close longtime friends with whom he has stayed in touch over the years. He is very close to these friends who are, he said, the kind of people that you would die for. Chip indicated that he also has close relations with his niece and nephew. In general, he is a family man. He counts on his family, and they have always been able to count on him. He loves his wife Martha, whom he describes as perfect and a very strong woman, and he loves her daughters as if they were my own. Chip is in good health and physically fit. He has never had surgery, psychological counseling, or medication for mental problems. His only run-in with the law came when he was 19 as a disturbing the peace arrest that carried a fine of $5, which he received for hollering too loud and long at a night game of hide-and-seek. He rarely smokes, drinks only a few beers a week, and has never used illegal drugs. Chip describes himself in the following way: very quiet, sometimes shy, down-to-earth, soft-hearted, very agreeable, and overall good person. However, it is important for us to note some additional self-descriptions. Chip usually fears being rejected by others, and so, in any disagreement, he often gives way in order to be accepted. He changes his mind to accommodate others so that they will not be mad at me or hate me. Others can influence him even when he believes that he has made up his mind. He does not like to be alone. He likes to be around others, and he becomes depressed when he is alone for any length of time. Some of my research on shyness provides empirical support for this shyness-conformity link. We have found that shy college students were likely to give in to and agree with others whose opinions were discrepant from their own when they believed they might have to defend their point of view openly, whereas they did not conform when they did not have to fear a public confrontation. The man is super patriotic. Every day he flies the American flag in his front yard and takes it down at sunset. He gives the flag as a gift to friends and family. I bought several flags to give to family, my place of business, and I flew them in Kuwait, every one of them. I think I had 9 or 10. I flew them when I was in Baghdad, and I'd send them to my wife, he said during our interview. Chip Frederick gets goosebumps and teary-eyed when he hears the national anthem. He wrote to me recently from his prison cell, "I am proud to say that I served most of my adult life for my country. I was very prepared to die for my country, my family and friends. I wanted to be the one to make a difference." I must admit that such feelings seem a bit over the top to someone with my more cautious brand of patriotism. His sister Mimi has this to say about her kid brother. "Growing up with Chip was a delight for me. I am 3 months shy of being 11 years older than he is. Chip was a quiet person. He was considerate of his peers. Chip always was thoughtful of others' feelings and was never a vengeful type person. Chip was ornery and liked practical jokes. He would always feed the dog peanut butter and would laugh so hard he would be on the ground rolling. Chip played sports and was a team player. His philosophy of life is fairness, and he still has a strong belief in that, responsibility and accountability. He was taught good morals and values by our parents. I remember watching him go off to the army at the young age of 17, just a kid, only to return a young man all grown up and demonstrating these same skills that he values so much. Chip likes to hunt and fish in his spare time. He enjoys sports, NASCAR, motorcycling, and spending time with his family." Frederick's corrections and army service record. Before being activated for duty in Iraq, Chip Frederick worked as a correctional officer in a small, medium-security prison, the Buckingham Correctional Center in Dilwyn, Virginia, for 5 years from December 1996. He was a floor officer in charge of supervising 60 to 120 inmates at any given time. While he was in institutional training, he met Martha, who was his trainer. The only blemish on his record is a reprimand he received for once wearing the wrong uniform. However, that is balanced by a citation he received for preventing an inmate's suicide. Before becoming a correctional officer, Frederick worked making eyeglasses at Bausch & Lomb. I was able to review many of his performance evaluations, which had been conducted annually by the Virginia Department of Corrections. A summary of key observations by various evaluating officers provides a sense of how well Chip progressed through probationary training to become a corrections officer. He typically exceeded expectations on almost all specific performance dimensions. CO Frederick has been proficient in performing this assigned duties for this probationary period. Has met all established performance standards. Officer Frederick shows initiative and does a very good job. April 1997. One negative blemish on his performance record with the Virginia Department of Corrections reads, "Employee needs to be more consistent on post assignments and enforce standing counts." November 1997. On all other six dimensions, he is rated as meets expectations, but as only fair but needs improvement on the dimension of initiating and completing count procedures. Recall the count procedure ordeal of the SPE? Otherwise, the comments are uniformly positive. He is a very good officer and shows leadership abilities. His appearance exceeds expectations. November 1998. This was also true of his handling keys and equipment. All the rest of the dimensions meet expectations. Officer Frederick meets all criteria and has the potential to be an excellent officer. Officer Frederick does an excellent job in controlling the custody, control, and safety of inmates. Officer Frederick is always neat and clean, shoes polished, and appears that he takes pride in his uniform. November 1999. Officer Frederick operates and maintains post in a safe, secure, and clean manner. When assigned to special housing, he keeps his area clean and prepared for inspections. Officer Frederick is always dressed properly for his shift assignment. He maintains his professional appearance. He works well with both his co-workers and inmates. He has a thorough knowledge of the work to be done and established policies and procedures. He has no problem assisting others in completing their job assignments. October 2000. Overall, these evaluations are increasingly positive, up to the point that Chip Frederick's performance exceeds expectations. However, it is instructive to note a key conclusion in one of these final reports. There were no factors beyond the employee's control which affected his performance. It is important to keep this in mind precisely because I will argue that situational factors beyond his control did undermine his performance at Abu Ghraib. In the final evaluations of Frederick in May 2001, his ratings were high. Officer Frederick does a very good job as the floor officer. He communicates well with the inmates in his area and on the strike force. Officer Frederick displays a high standard of professional conduct and appearance. Officer Frederick does a very good job enforcing all written policies. Officer Frederick does a very good job taking counts. It is obvious that Chip Frederick became a valuable corrections officer who was highly effective when he had explicit procedures and written policies to follow. He clearly learned on the job and benefited from the surveillance and feedback of his supervisors. He is also someone for whom appearance and grooming is important, as is maintaining a professional demeanor. Those qualities, which are central in Chip's personal identity, would be under assault by the horrible conditions we've noted existed at Abu Ghraib prison and were even worse on the night shift on Tier 1A. Chip joined the armed forces in 1984 for the money and the experience and to be with friends. It also seemed the patriotic thing to do at that time. He served for more than 11 years in the National Guard in a combat engineer unit and added to that service 10 more years in the military police of the Army Reserve. The only negative mark on his record was one he got for being late for formation early in his career. After being activated, his first tour of duty was in Kuwait in May 2003, and then in a small town, Al-Hilah, south of Baghdad, where he served with half a dozen close buddies in the 372nd MP Company. He was an operations sergeant charged with sending out patrols. The mission was great. The locals loved us. There were no major incidents or injuries. It was peaceful till we left, and Polish coalition forces took over. I made it a point to learn about the culture. I learned a little Arabic, and I made sure I interacted with the people. I sent packets full of candies to my kids in that village. My kids were always cheering for me. Frederick also reported that he continues to be proud that he was able to make those children smile just by listening to them and taking the time to play with them. During that time, he was able to satisfy his overwhelming desire for neatness by semi-pressing his uniform. This meant that after washing and drying his uniform, he put it under a plywood board underneath his mattress and slept on it for a week. He was the only soldier who had creases in his pants, and he was ragged for it, but he didn't care. Because that's just me. I don't like to be sloppy. He describes himself as a perfectionist who always likes things to be nice, neat, and clean. His penchant for being neat was so extreme that it would sometimes drive his wife crazy. Unfortunately, there was little time and no reason for such neatness in Abu Ghraib prison, where he arrived early in October 2003. One indication of Chip Frederick's exemplary service as a soldier for his nation comes from a review of the many awards he has earned over the years. They include Army Achievement Medal, awarded 3 times, Army Reserve Components Medal, awarded 4 times, National Defense Medal, awarded 2 times. Armed Forces Reserve Medal with M device. Non-commissioned Officers Professional Development Ribbon. Army Service Ribbon. Army Reserve Components Overseas Training Ribbon, awarded 2 times. Global War on Terrorism Medal. And Global War on Terrorism Expeditionary Medal. He was also about to receive a Bronze Star for the effective way he had dealt with a shooting incident with a Syrian detainee in Abu Ghraib, but which was not rewarded after the abuse revelations surfaced. These are some rather impressive credentials as far as I am concerned, especially for someone later alleged to be a rogue soldier. Psychological assessments. Chip's IQ falls in the average range on the combined measures of verbal and performance intelligence on standard tests. Three measures of personality and emotional functioning contain validity scales that assess how the person being tested portrays him or herself across all test items, picking up lying, defensiveness, and falsifying answers. Chip showed no tendency to present himself in either an overly positive or overly negative light in regard to psychological functioning. However, it is important to highlight the conclusion. Validity scales indicate the patient presented himself as a morally virtuous individual, according to the military psychologist conducting the assessment. In addition, these standardized test results indicate that Chip Frederick has no sadistic or pathological tendencies. That conclusion strongly suggests that the bad apple dispositional attribution of blame made against him by military and administration apologists has no basis in fact. Test results suggest a core motivation for the patient to obtain and maintain nurturance and supportive relationships. He is expected to be obliging, docile, and placating, while seeking relationships in which he can lean on others for emotional support, affection, nurture, and security. His temperament will likely be pacifying, and he will try to avoid conflict. In this regard, he will have a general tendency to hesitate in expressing negative feelings for fear of alienating others. He will exhibit an excessive need for both security and attachment and to be taken care of, and he will likely feel uneasy when alone. This underlies, in part, his tendency to submit to the wishes of others in order to maintain security. The independent evaluation of Chip Frederick's personality assessment by an expert clinical psychologist, Dr. Larry Butler, indicates substantial agreement with the conclusions by the Army clinical psychologist. First, he notes that the results of the assessment can be considered reasonably reliable and valid indicators of his, Frederick's, current functioning. Dr. Butler goes on to say, in bold type, "It should also be noted that there is no evidence of gross pathology. He is not manifesting serious personality or Axis I pathology." This means that Chip shows no evidence at all of a psychopathic personality that would predispose him to be abusive without guilt in his work setting. He also falls into the normal healthy range with regard to schizophrenia, depression, hysteria, and all other major forms of psychological pathology. However, Dr. Butler also says that, in his considered opinion, a syndrome of underlying psychological traits raises concerns about Chip's leadership in complex, demanding situations, such as those he encountered at Abu Ghraib. These symptoms of Frederick's are likely to impede his ability to respond to new situations and may reduce his flexibility and ability to adapt to change. He is likely to be indecisive, insecure, and to rely on others to help him make decisions. He seeks assurance of his worth and acknowledgement of his efforts, and is quite dependent on others to help him set and keep an agenda or make decisions. He is easily led by others and, in spite of his best efforts to do what is right, is likely to be over-controlled by circumstances, authorities, and peer pressures. These reports make evident that Staff Sergeant Chip Frederick would make a good social-emotional leader, but not as good a task leader, a distinction that researchers on leadership use to distinguish two contrasting leadership styles. A social-emotional leader is sensitive to the needs of those in his organization and engages in activities that will promote a positive quality of group membership. On the other hand, a task leader focuses on the more formal aspects of leadership, setting agendas and standards, providing assignments, and giving informational feedback to achieve the group's goals. Ideally, a group leader should possess both traits, but often the job is divided among several leaders, each of whom is best at one or the other set of attributes. Groups need effective task leaders more than they do good social-emotional ones in situations that are ambiguous, that involve shifting demands, and that lack explicit objectives. A classic example of the night shift job setting on Tier 1A. As good as Chip may have been in previous leadership or correctional circumstances, He was simply the wrong person for the complex job of leader on that shift, at that time, in that place. Chip Frederick also completed the primary assessment of an individual's extent and type of psychological burnout within an organizational setting. He did so by imagining his work situation as it was when he was at Abu Ghraib. The Maslach Burnout Inventory, MBI, identifies three aspects of a person's relationship with a specific work setting: emotional exhaustion, cynicism, and personal efficacy. It was developed by Christina Maslach, recall the heroine of the Stanford Prison Experiment. The measure was later refined and extended in her research with Dr. Michael Leiter, who provided a blind analysis of Frederick's reactions. That is, he was unaware of who the client was and of his specific work setting. According to Dr. Leiter, Chip's scores reveal an unusual profile of burnout on these three dimensions. Ordinarily, a high degree of exhaustion, elevated cynicism, and a reduced sense of personal effectiveness at work go together in characterizing job burnout. However, Chip showed few signs of cynicism or a negative evaluation of his personal work effectiveness. Nonetheless, he does show extreme emotional exhaustion. The profile indicated a person experiencing extreme exhaustion, which is the defining quality of burnout. Specifically, the assessment indicates a person who is emotionally drained and chronically tired. His recovery cycles are not providing sufficient rest or relief from work to permit him to replenish his energy, leading to a condition of chronic weariness. It is evident that his current state is contrary to the individual's identity. He thinks of himself as capable of managing serious demands, but is overwhelmed in his current circumstances. Overall, this profile indicates a person experiencing job burnout that is specific to the work situation in question. The profile suggests that under different work circumstances, he could be a productive and enthusiastic contributor. Research in cognitive psychology shows that performance on a variety of tasks is undermined by conditions, such as chronic stress and multitasking, that impose an excessive load on a person's cognitive resources. Memory and problem-solving, as well as judgment and decision-making, all suffer when the mind's usual capacity is overextended. I will argue that Chip's ordinary level of cognitive capacities was indeed overwhelmed by the inordinate load imposed on him by the situational demands he faced nightly at his new overwhelming job. With these clues in mind, let us now turn our focus on the work circumstance alluded to in Dr. Leiter's report. From Chip's perspective, what was it like to work on Tier 1A during the night shift? I invite you, the reader, to assume the same mindset that you used earlier in our journey when you imagined that you were a participant or a subject in various social psychological experiments. Try walking in Chip Frederick's boots for a few months, from October to December 2003. A bad apple or a chip off the best block? Before we leave our dispositional analysis to consider the situational forces at play, we must keep in mind that this young man brought no pathology into that situation. There is absolutely nothing in his record that I was able to uncover that would predict that Chip Frederick would engage in any form of abusive, sadistic behavior. On the contrary, there is much in his record to suggest that, had he not been forced to work and live in such an abnormal situation, he might have been the military's all-American poster soldier on its recruitment ads. He could have been used honestly in place of the military's fabricated pseudo-heroes, Privates Jessica Lynch and Pat Tillman. The military could have used Staff Sergeant Ivan Frederick as a super patriot who loved his country and was ready to serve it to the last drop of his blood. He could have been the best of apples in their good barrel. In a sense, Chip Frederick also could have been one of the participants in our Stanford Prison Experiment, who we knew were good young men, normal and healthy, before they went down into that prison basement. Although he does not share their intelligence level or middle-class background, Chip can be compared with them in starting out as a tabula rasa, a clean slate, which would soon become boldly etched upon by a pathological prison setting. What was the situation that brought out the worst in this otherwise good soldier? How could it have indelibly etched itself on him, distorting his usual mental and behavioral functioning? What was the nature of the barrel into which this once good apple was dropped? The Situation: Nightmares and Night Games on Tier 1A. Because he had prior experience in corrections, Staff Sergeant Frederick was assigned to be in charge of a small group of other Army Reserve military police on the night shift at Abu Ghraib. He had to oversee activities on four tiers in the hard site, that is, inside the concrete structure rather than outside in the tent camps surrounded by barbed wire. One of those camps was Camp Vigilant, later changed to Camp Redemption, which had four separate compounds. Within Tier 1A, Alpha, was a special facility designed for inmate or detainee interrogations. They were usually conducted by civilian contract interrogators, some aided by translators hired by the Titan Corporation, and only loosely supervised by military intelligence, the CIA, and other service branches. At first, Staff Sergeant Frederick was responsible for about 400 prisoners. That was in early October 2003, when his 372nd Military Police Army Reserve Company, based in Cressoptown, Maryland, replaced the 72nd Military Police National Guard Company. Initially, he was able to handle the complex assignments handed to him, even though it was an escalation from the 100 or so medium security prisoners he had had under his command back home. However, not long after President Bush had declared mission accomplished, instead of the Iraqi citizenry being supportive, all hell broke loose. Insurgency and foreign terrorism against the U.S. and coalition occupation surged out of control. No one had anticipated how extensive, coordinated, and deadly it would be, and would continue to grow out of control. Revenge for the deaths of so many soldiers mixed freely with fear and uncertainty about how to contain this eruption. Orders were sent out to round up all likely suspects in towns where any insurgent violence had erupted. That meant widespread arrests of whole families, especially adult males. The detention system was not able to process this new load adequately. Record-keeping on detainees and their likely interrogation value fell by the wayside, and basic resources became completely inadequate under the pressure of an inmate population that doubled in November and nearly tripled to more than 1,000 by December. Chip was required to be in charge of all of them, and in addition to being in charge of a dozen or so MPs, to oversee the 50 to 70 Iraqi police who were guarding more than 1,000 Iraqis imprisoned on various criminal charges. The Iraqi police, who worked tiers 2, 3, and 4, were notorious for smuggling in weapons and other contraband to inmates for a fee. Although the average age of the prisoners was in the range of 20, there were also up to 50 adolescents, as well as children as young as 10 years old and seniors in their 60s. All housed together in huge cells. Female prisoners, prostitutes, and the wives of generals and men who had been important leaders in Saddam's party were housed in Tier 1B, Bravo. Each of the Alpha and Bravo tiers held about 50 prisoners at any one time. In short, being in charge of this complex facility without adequate resources and a suddenly erupting foreign prisoner population placed a heavy burden upon someone whose prior experience had been limited to policing a small number of medium-security civilian prisoners in a small town in Virginia. Training and Accountability. Zimbardo: please tell me about your training to be a guard leader in this prison. Frederick: none. No training for this job. When we mobilized at Fort Lee, we had a cultural awareness class. Maybe it was about 45 minutes long, and it was basically about not to discuss politics, not to discuss religion, and not to call them Arabs, don't call them camel jockeys, towel heads, or not to call them ragheads, Arabs. Z. How would you describe the supervision you received and the accountability you felt you had toward your superior officers? Frederick. None. Z. Who was your direct superior officer to whom you reported? Frederick. Sergeant First Class Snyder. I was in charge of the four tiers, and he was in charge of me, and it keeps going up the chain. Next in line is Captain Brinson. Above Captain Brinson is Captain Reese. Above Reese is Lieutenant Colonel Philibom. Frederick's shift began at 4 p.m. and lasted for 12 hours, until 4 a.m. He went on to report that few of these officers were ever present on Alpha Tier at night, or made even brief appearances early in the shift. He had no supervision from Sergeant Snyder because his superior had no professional training in corrections. However, at various times, Chip did offer suggestions and recommended changes to Snyder, Brinson, and Reese. Z. You would make recommendations? Frederick. Yes, about operation of the facility. Not to handcuff prisoners to cell doors, should not have prisoners nude except for self-mutilators, can't handle prisoners with mental conditions. One of the first things that I asked for as soon as I got there was regulations. Operating procedures. I was housing juveniles, men, women, and mentally ill prisoners all in the same thing. It's a violation of the military code. Z. So you would try to get up the chain of command? Frederick. I would tell anybody that would come in who I thought had some ranking. Usually they would tell me, just see what you can come up with. Keep up the good work. This is the way military intelligence wants it done. At other times, Chip said that he would be scoffed at or reprimanded by higher-ups for complaining. Given the combat zone conditions, they told him, he would have to make do as best possible. He was surely not in Kansas or the Dilwyn, Virginia prison. There would never be any clear written procedures, no formal policies, and no structured guidelines. There was none of the procedural support that Chip Frederick needed to follow in order to be the kind of leader he hoped to be in this most important mission in his life. He was on his own, without any support system upon which he could rely. This was exactly the worst working condition for him, given Chip Frederick's basic needs and values, which we have just reviewed from his assessments. It was a sure recipe for failure. And that was only the beginning. Non-stop night work. Not only did this soldier work half around the clock, he did so 7 days a week with not a single day off for a full 40 days. Then he had only one day off, followed by two more solid weeks on, before he could get a regular day off after four nights on. I can't imagine any job where such a work schedule would not be seen as inhumane. Given the shortage of trained corrections personnel, and perhaps the failure of his superiors to appreciate the extent of this overwhelming daily workload, there was no recognition of or concern for Chip Frederick's job stress and burnout potential. He had to do what they wanted him to do, and simply stop complaining to his superiors. Where did he go at 4 a.m. when his long 12-hour shift was over? He simply went to sleep in another part of the prison. In a prison cell. He slept in a 6-by-9-foot prison cell that had no toilet, but did have plenty of rodents running around it. It was dirty because there were not enough cleaning supplies and not enough water to clean it up. Chip Frederick told me during our interview, I couldn't find supplies to keep the facilities clean. The plumbing was bad. Shit was backed up in the porta-potties. There was trash and mold everywhere. It was nasty in there. There were human body parts in the facility. There was a pack of wild dogs running around, still present from the days when prisoners executed by Saddam were buried in part of the prison, and wild dogs would dig up their remains. You know, I was so mentally drained when I got off in the morning, all I wanted to do is sleep. He missed breakfast, lunch, often had only one meal a day, which consisted of tea rations and not-so-tasty MREs, The Army issue meals ready to be eaten out of containers. Portions were small due to the large number of soldiers that had to be fed. I ate a lot of cheese and crackers, Chip reported. Other emerging health problems for this athletic, socially minded young man were that he stopped exercising because he was always tired, and he was not able to socialize with buddies because of work schedule conflicts. More and more, his life revolved entirely around his prison supervision and the MP reservists working there under his command. They soon became what social psychologists refer to as his reference group, a new in-group that would come to have a big influence on him. He was enmeshed in a total situation of the kind that the psychologist Robert J. Lifton had earlier described as facilitating mind control in cults and in the North Korean prisoner of war camps. Many others on the all-night scene. The two MP reservists who served most often on the night shift in Alpha Tier were Corporal Charles Greener, Jr. and Specialist Megan Ambule. Greener was put in direct charge of Tier 1A during the night shift, given that Chip had to move around to supervise the other tiers. When they were off duty, Specialist Sabrina Harmon replaced them. Sometimes Sergeant Javal Davis would fill in. Private First Class Lindy England was a file clerk who was not assigned to this duty, but visited often to be with her boyfriend, Charles Greener. She celebrated her 21st birthday on the tier. Specialist Armin Cruz of the 325th Military Intelligence Battalion was also frequently around that tier. There were also dog handlers, soldiers who came on the tier to use their dogs either to intimidate prisoners into talking or to force prisoners out of their cells if they were suspected of having weapons or just for a show of force. Five such teams were sent to Abu Ghraib in November 2003, having had practice at the Guantanamo Bay prison. Two of these dog handlers, who were later found guilty of prisoner abuse, were Sergeant Michael Smith and Staff Sergeant Santos Cardona. Nurses and medics also visited on occasion when some special medical problem arose. Also present were a number of civilian contractors from the Titan Corporation who did the interrogation of those detainees suspected of having information about insurgency activities or knowledge of terrorist activities. They often required translators to assist them in their interactions with the detainee suspects. FBI, CIA, and military intelligence personnel were also around at times for special interrogations. As might be expected, high-ranking military visitors were rarely around in the middle of the night. Commander Karpinski never visited Tiers 1A or B during the months that Chip was on duty, except once when giving a TV tour. One reservist in that unit reported seeing Karpinski only twice in the 5 months he was at Abu Ghraib. A few other officers made brief appearances in the late afternoon. Chip used those rare occasions to report problems with the facility and to suggest changes he hoped could be made. None ever was. Various other people, who were not in uniform and had no identification, came and went to and from these two tiers. No one was supposed to ask to see their credentials, so they operated in total anonymity. Against the rules of military conduct, civilian contractors gave orders to the MP guards about things they wanted done to prepare particular prisoners for interrogation. Soldiers on duty are not supposed to take orders from civilians. This line has become increasingly blurred with the rise in use of civilian contract personnel to fulfill roles previously handled by military intelligence. Chip's letters and email messages home clearly told that a key function that he and the other MP reservists on Tier 1 Alpha served was to help the interrogators do their job more effectively. Military intelligence has encouraged and told us, "Great job." They usually don't allow others to watch them interrogate, but since they like the way I run the prison, they have made an exception. He was proud to report that his men were good at doing what they were asked to do, softening up detainees so they would give up the information interrogators wanted. "We help getting them to talk with the way we handle them. We've had a very high rate with our style of getting them to break. They usually end up breaking within hours." Ship's messages home repeatedly noted that military intelligence teams, which included CIA officers and linguists and interrogators from private defense contractors, dominated all of the action that occurred in that dungeon facility of Abu Ghraib. He told me that he could not identify any of these interrogators because they had deliberately made themselves anonymous. They rarely gave their names and had no IDs on their uniform. In fact, most of them did not even wear a military outfit. Ship's account squares with media accounts about the climate created by General Sanchez's insistence that the best way to get actionable intelligence from detainees was by extreme methods of interrogation and secrecy. Some rules for U.S. military personnel at the prison made it easy for people to duck responsibility for their actions, a factor that may also have opened the door to abuse. According to an undated prison memo titled Operational Guidelines, which covered the High Security Cell Block, Tier 1A, the acronym MI, Military Intelligence, will not be used in the area. Additionally, it is recommended that all military personnel in the segregation area reduce knowledge of their true identities to these specialized detainees. The use of sterilized uniforms, cleansed of all identification, is highly suggested, and personnel should not address each other by true name and rank in the segregation area. The Army's own investigations revealed the truth of Frederick's descriptions about the extreme strategies that were employed in the prison. They found that interrogators had encouraged MP reservists working in the prison to prepare Iraqi detainees for questioning, physically and mentally. The traditionally established line between MPs dealing only with detention procedures and military intelligence personnel working on intelligence gathering was blurred when these reservists were recruited to assist in prepping detainees for coercive interrogation. Military intelligence agents were also guilty of some of the worst abuses. For example, in order to obtain information from one Iraqi general, interrogators soaked down his 16-year-old son, smeared him with mud, and then drove him naked out into the cold. Sergeant Samuel Provenance, Alpha Company, 302nd Military Intelligence Battalion, reported to several news agencies that two of the interrogators had sexually abused a female teenager and that other personnel were aware of this abuse. We will see in the next chapter that much worse abuses were committed by any number of soldiers and civilians in addition to those by Chip Frederick's MP night shift crew. I hope the investigation of inmate abuses is including not only the people who committed the crimes, but some of the people that might have encouraged these crimes as well, said Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, Deputy Director for Coalition Operations in Iraq, in an interview with Dan Rather on 60 Minutes 2. Because they certainly share some level of responsibility as well. We will note that the system has been slow in accusing and investigating its own officials. Chip Frederick also had general custody of 15 to 20 ghost detainees, prisoners who were listed only as OGA, Other Government Agency, Property. Because they were assumed to be high-ranking officials who had valuable information to give, the interrogators were given latitude to use all means necessary to extract that actionable information. These detainees were ghosts because there was no official record of them ever having been at that site, never officially listed, without any ID. During our interview, Chip confided, "I saw one of them after he was killed by Delta Force soldiers. They killed this guy. I got the impression that nobody cared. Nobody cared what happened in there." That guy was a ghost detainee who had been severely beaten by a Navy SEALs unit, then hung on a rack during interrogation by a CIA agent, suffocated to death, then packed in ice and put into a body bag with an IV inserted in his arm by a medic, so that his murderers could pretend he was sick and being taken to the hospital in the morning. Before he was dumped somewhere by a cab driver, some of the MPs, Grainer and Harmon, on the night shift, had their pictures taken with him as souvenirs, just for the record. We will revisit this case in more detail in the following chapter. However, the effect of the MPs on night shift witnessing these and other instances of grim abuse by a variety of visitors to their Tier 1A was certainly to establish a new social norm of abuse acceptability. If it were possible to get away with murder, what harm was there in just smacking around some resistant detainees, or embarrassing them by making them take humiliating positions, they reasoned. The fear factor. There was much to fear within those prison walls, not only for the prisoners, but also for Chip Frederick and all the other guards. As is the case in most prisons, prisoners with time on their hands and ingenuity will fashion weapons out of virtually anything available to them. Here, their weapons were made from metal broken off from beds or windows, broken glass, and sharpened toothbrushes. With less ingenuity and some money, prisoners could bribe the Iraqi guards to supply them with guns, knives, bayonets, and ammunition. For a fee, these guards would also transfer notes and letters to and from family members. Frederick had been warned by guys in the 72nd MP Company, which his unit replaced, that many of the Iraqi guards were very corrupt. They even assisted escape attempts by providing security information, facility maps, clothes, and weapons. They also smuggled in drugs to the detainees. Although Frederick was nominally in charge of these guards, they would refuse to make rounds of the tiers, and usually they just sat around on tables outside the tier, smoking and talking. This must be added to all the other sources of Chip Frederick's constant frustrations and stress in running a secure facility. Prisoners regularly assaulted the guards verbally and physically. Some threw feces at them, and others used their long fingernails to scratch the guards' faces. One of the most frightening and unexpected series of events on the tier happened on November 24, 2003, when Iraqi police smuggled a handgun, ammo, and bayonets into the cell of a suspected Syrian insurgent. Chip's small force had a shootout with him, and they were able to subdue him without killing him. However, that event raised the bar for everyone in that place to be eternally vigilant and even more fearful of lethal attacks against them. Prisoner riots occurred over the poor quality of the food, which was often inedible and insufficient. Riots were also likely to erupt when mortar attacks exploded nearby in Abu Ghraib's soft site.